This is the Tan Talk Radio Network.
This is Patsy with a Z. Welcome to Joy on Paper, a program for writers and those who dream of writing. And for everyone who wants to know the story behind the book, coming to you from Tan Talk Radio Network Studio, here in glorious Clearwater, Florida, the perfect place for writers to write and readers to enjoy a good book. Well, I am so thrilled today. I have back with me one of my favorite authors, someone I admire so much. It's just always a thrill for me to talk to Margaret George, because I think she is one of the most brilliant historical authors in the world. Hi, Margaret.
Oh, hello. Now you're making me blush.
Well, Margaret, you know, I am so thrilled that you're back on Joy on Paper, because for me, I love talking to authors, all types of authors. I have such an eclectic taste. Young adult authors, and I talk to authors who write sci-fi, and I talk to picture book authors. But when it comes down to it, the reading that I do the most, and that I've always done since I was a child, I love history. And so for me, your books are like, they are just golden.
Well, thank you. Yeah, I love history too. I was actually just at a wonderful history book festival in Lewis, Delaware, which was both nonfiction and fiction history books. And it's unusual to have such a specialized book festival, but it was just great because it was all different periods and all different interests, and so it was really fun. And there were a lot of history lovers there, so there must be a lot of us out there.
Well, I think you know, it's funny. In a way, for a while there, I wasn't so hopeful about people continuing to read history. But in a way, the streaming video that's come along has helped, because mm-hmm. people are seeing these programs and they're saying, "Well, I'd like to know more."
Yeah, yeah.
And so it is drawing. I think these programs are drawing readers in, and I noticed that. For The Tudors, which is one of the streaming videos out there, that the fans selected your Henry VIII as the book that, you know, one of the books that a person should read if they want to know more.
That's true. Yeah, yeah, it is a big help. That's just great. So I wish for more of it. And who knows? Who knows what they'll be doing next?
Well, I actually hope that they do your Henry VIII, because...
Yeah, it's time to have another Henry.
Yes.
You know, it's been a long time since, well, The Tudors was, it is, even that isn't that recent. I think of it as recent, but, you know, time flies by. But the one in the 1970s, you know, it was The Six Wives of Henry VIII, and it was 9 hours, because it was a big miniseries. So, and that had a big influence. There was a lot of interest in that, but that's, of course, been, 40 years ago?
Well, it's hard to believe that your Henry VIII came out in 1986.
I know, 33 years ago.
I know, and I remember when I was reading it. I have this phenomenal memory where I can remember where I was reading a book. I was talking to David Baldacci one day, and I said, "Well, you know, I was reading your book and this location on that day." And he said, "How do you know that?" I said, "Because I remember the book." And so I get into, you know, I have this visual of myself reading a book. And so I remember when Henry VIII came. And that was sort of my, of course, I lived in England. So I had been to all of these places mm-hmm. that you wrote about in that book. And I was so thrilled at the time when I read it. And then when I started this program and I reread it, I was even more impressed. It is how you, for people who haven't read it, this is an autobiography written by Henry. And Margaret George somehow becomes Henry in this book. I mean, I don't know. It's like you were possessed almost.
Yeah, I feel like I was. I have to say, you do kind of feel like you've been taken over by this other person who has kind of, employed you to tell their story because they can't anymore. So they've conscripted you in a way, and you do want them to be pleased with it. I mean, that's really who you're writing for is would they be pleased with the work, which is not necessarily the same audience that's going to end up reading it, of course.
but I think Henry would. I think you did such a terrific job with that book.
Well, thank you.
Forevermore, for me, that is Henry. And I think that what I like about it is that everybody else makes him so evil. Yes, he did evil things because they did evil things, but I thought it was so well-rounded, and I think we really get into why he did things, why he felt certain things, and I think it's fantastic.
Well, thank you. Well, that's what I was aiming for. I wanted to tell his side of the story, because as I said, he's been kind of like a paper villain to a lot of people, and plus, all the other books that I had read, they're always told, first of all, they tend to be episodic. So there's like one book about Anne Boleyn, and it's told from her point of view. And then there's another book about Thomas More, and it's told from his point of view. There was nobody who strung them all together so that there was context for each of these episodes in his life. And so once you put it together as a story from his point of view, it becomes a different kind of story. Of course, you know, you shift the lighting with any kind of point of view, and you're going to get a different story. So anyway, but so far, you know, it's interesting that there hasn't been yet another one. Oh, I should knock on wood.
Well, no, I don't think he possessed you. Let's just say I think Henry came. Yeah. Well, there he found you wherever you were at the time, and he just said, "Okay, this is the one I want to tell my story," you know, it's like, famous people, they select somebody they want to write their story.
That's true. They commission them. And I guess I felt that way. And then the other male, it's interesting. My first book was about Henry VIII, who was a male. And then there are all the ones in the middle are women. And then I just finished the Nero on the other end, another misunderstood character. And the paperback of the part two is out today. So that's kind of the bookend to the books I've written, with Henry on one end and Nero on the other. So, some people sort of see a similarity between them, but I don't really think, I mean, they're very different.
Yeah, no, I don't see the similarity, but The Splendor Before the Dark, which was the second book in the Nero series, so it comes out in paperback today.
Right. Yep.
Wow, that's fantastic. Well, everybody, it's you could read it as a standalone, but the first book, of course, is The Confessions of Young Nero. And as a companion piece, that the two of them work so beautifully together. It really, as I said, with the young Nero, it really gives us a whole new view of Nero that we've, you know, never seen in a film or read about in books or in plays. And it's really, I think it's a refreshing look. And certainly things in that book that I had never heard about. And that's why I think it's such a wonderful book.
Well, thank you. Yeah, we never think of famous people as ever being children or young people. We only think about them when they come onto the stage, you know. But of course, there's a lot that predates that.
Well, you know, when, of course, as we said, Henry came out in 1986, and then I was going to talk to you next about your next book after that, which was Mary, Queen of Scots. The proper title is what? Mary, Queen of Scotland and the Isles.
And the Isles, because I love that was her official title.
Yeah.
I thought it was really a pretty title to have, so I that's why I gave it that. That's her official title. Yeah. And the Isles.
I did like that. Mary, Queen of Scotland and the Isles. It does sound very nice. But I think I would prefer today to talk more about, just because I find Elizabeth so fascinating in this book, the way you've done it.
Mm-hmm.
So it's a big gap of years.
Oh, yeah.
And in some ways you'd think that maybe you would have gone straight to do Elizabeth after Henry. But you went to Scotland and went up there and did this. And then came after many years, but during those many years, you must have done a lot of research about Elizabeth.
Yeah, and I felt that, Elizabeth's childhood is in Henry VIII. I don't like to do things over again. So her childhood up till she was 13 is in Henry VIII, and that's when he died and left her, with no parent at all, because, of course, we know her mother, Anne Boleyn, had been executed. And then the middle years, which are really interesting, were all covered in Mary, Queen of Scots, because that goes up to 1587. And so I wanted to cover the last part of her life, which starts with the Spanish Armada in 1588. And the reason the Spanish Armada even came was because as long as Mary Queen of Scots was still in England and there was a hope that the Catholics would manage to put her on the throne, if Spain wanted England to become Catholic and revert back to the true faith, now they were going to have to invade it themselves. There wasn't going to be any body on the ground already in England that could carry this out. So, therefore, you launched the Spanish Armada. And we all know how that happened, what happened. but it was interesting because often she lived for another 15 years after that. And so it was an interesting time because, for one thing, most movies and books about her kind of stop with the Spanish Armada and the great victory of the Spanish Armada and the speech that she gave about, laying down her life and her body in the dust for her people. But they forget that there was another 15 years. And that was almost had a lot of modern concerns because then the succession became very important. How long was she going to live? People didn't expect her to live that much longer. She was already 55 when the Spanish Armada happened. And people just didn't live that long at that time. I mean, nobody in her family lived very long. And so why would she live longer? So there began to be all these, kind of watchers that were noticing every single thing she did to see, did they spy any weakness? And so the whole concept of what people, and especially women of power, have to put up with all the business about aging, And the lengths to which she went to kind of disguise the fact that she might be showing any signs of weakness or aging was quite fascinating because she was a very stern-willed person, but she had to kind of put on these external shows to show that she was still young and vibrant. So she would, she would go on these long rides and say, the young and able come with me, and the old people stay at home, even if the next day she was really sore and didn't want to get out of bed. she rounded up all the pictures being painted of her that showed her looking old, and they were, you couldn't show them. Very few have survived. Very interesting. There are few that kind of slipped through her network, but she had an official kind of portrait that showed her eternally youthful. And those are the portraits you see of her. You had to follow this official kind of an outline. But when you see the very few that showed how old she really looked, you realize that, she was really was part of an image spin. But she really stayed stayed in control almost till the very end. But I really enjoyed doing the study of an older woman and the whole aspect of aging and the whole aspect of power and how do you retain it. We have an elected kind of government where we do have term limitations, but in those days there were no term limitations. So I'm glad I waited. I said I have to be older before I can write this book. And that's true, because I think you have to have experience
Because you handle the aging so deftly, with such delicacy, and it's very touching the way you explain how as she got older, how she would forget things and write notes to herself.
Yes. Of course, so, you have to have done that yourself before what did I come into this room for? You know, I came in here to get something. What was it? Well, of course, she couldn't show that to her courtiers. I mean, what if somebody noticed? It's okay if you do it in your own house or in front of your family, but good heavens, you wouldn't want anybody at court to see you doing that. So I think I had the experience of some of those things, and I could imagine what it would be like if I were a powerful person. And of course, you know, in our presidents, I mean, you know, look at Reagan and how people started noticing that he didn't seem to be as sharp as he had been, and he's having problems, and you know, there's all these speculations about him, and when did his Alzheimer's really start? And so, yeah, it was. I had a lot more to draw on by waiting those years to write that book.
Well, and it works so beautifully because as she's aging, as she faces these changes that occur to her in her life. Well, even when when she's in her mid 50s, and tell the story about Dr. Lopez, about this. A Portuguese doctor who was
the one who put the poison on her saddle. I think it was Dr. Perry.
Yeah, no, not
what
that
about,
one.
What about Lopez?
The one who gave her, a box of that they thought might be poisoned. Later on, he was I think when she was going through menopause, and gave her some medicines to help.
Well, they did. I'm sure they did have medicines, or what they thought were medicines at the time. But of course, you wouldn't want to be seen taking them. So
yeah, so
you'd have to take them secretly. You wouldn't want to be seen doing that. I just tried to imagine what it would. Some of the things that confronted her every day, really. You know, everyday kind of things.
And of course, she always had a circle of women around her, young women. So this is not always difficult when you're growing older and you have to have a bunch of 20-year-olds around you.
Yeah, I know. You know all the jokes now about if you have problems with a computer, ask your grandchild. Because that's true. Because you know, I was talking to as a high school kid who actually helps take care of my tortoise when I'm away, and so I know him and his family pretty well. And I was just explaining something about my computer, and so he said, "Oh," he said, "well, I'll come over and take a look at it." I can figure out how to do that. And I thought, well, you know, that's the difference between the generation that learned it when they were already adults and the generation that grew up with it.
And of course, with her, you know, having to keep this youthful image and having these young women around didn't always help because she was in competition with many of the men in her life. It was a complex situation for her.
Very complex. And you know, there's, if you look at pictures of famous people, celebrities, I mean movie stars and actors and so on, and you know, they do everything in their power to still stay young looking, and they've got all the money and all the tricks to do it. But you look at a picture of them now and a picture of them then, and they decidedly look older. No matter how they try to hide it, they just look older. And especially when you see those some TV shows that have run for years, and then you see reruns of it, and you know, it's like, if these people can't fake it very well, and they fake it sort of well, but they don't really pull it off. Well, what about ordinary people? And what about Elizabeth, who didn't have all those things? She didn't have collagen injections
and Botox,
none of that stuff. You know, she just was kind of on her own to do the best she could. Well, of course, she had her wigs, which I guess she started wearing probably when her hair turned gray. She still have hair. There's some kind of a legend that she was bald, but that's not true, because there's some locks of her hair in one of the one of the noble houses that I guess she left. It's in a locket, and you can see that she had hair just gray. So she just put on her wigs. And of course, Mary Queen of Scots wore wigs too. So women had that, but that's about all they had. And I'm not sure about the stuff about the white, you know, the white
face
powder. Yeah. I mean, in the movies you've seen recently, it's like she puts it on so she can look scary, but she probably put it on to try to, smooth out her blotchy complexion or hide things. And, of course, we know that lead is a really bad thing to put on your face, but they didn't know that then. But she was, she was trying.
Who is it? Betty Davis really did a job on that. But speaking of the actresses who have played her, have you seen many of the movies?
Yeah, I think I've seen most of them. I think the absolute best one, hands down, is Glinda Jackson. I mean, I saw her, she made that six-part, followed the Six Wives of Henry VIII, then there was Elizabeth R., and she played Elizabeth, and it also was a nine-hour thing. And then I saw her in the 1970, it was a long time ago, a movie of Mary, Queen of Scots, but it had Vanessa Redgrave as Mary, and it had Glinda Jackson again playing Elizabeth. And I just think she gets both the steeliness, the power, and the power just of her presence. And of course, her very crisp diction. I just saw Glinda Jackson, now she's in her 80s, playing King Lear on Broadway.
Huh.
And, it was Glinda Jackson's her personality. But I think she was probably the most like Elizabeth. I can't say for Betty Davis, because that was kind of a silly movie with her in Essex. And as for Margot Robbie, was okay. But she didn't have the power of Glinda Jackson, I don't think. And there have been some other ones.
Certainly Elizabeth had to have had power, because she had to control so many very strong men.
Yeah.
There were so many in her life that she... people who flattered her, people who wanted to, get her to do something for them or give them something... And so she was always in this situation where she had to control men, and because so many of them wanted to take advantage of her.
Yeah, and she was very clever, because she knew how to flatter people, and she knew how to play helpless. And there was some French ambassador said she is a princess who can play any part she wishes, and she could be very sort of, oh, I'm a poor, helpless woman. Margot Robbie kind of did that in the Mary, Queen of Scots, but it was the Mary, Queen of Scots movie, where she acted very helpless to her people, men. But I don't think Elizabeth ever really did that, but she was very able to kind of slither away and give what she called her answers answerless. Kind of keep people on their toes. Nobody quite knew whether she meant what she said. Did she really mean that she really meant to get married? But Parliament was saying, now you've got to get married. You've got to give us an heir. You have to do this. You love your country, and she would. She said, I have nothing I want more than to marry. And then she gave some excuse, when they kept pestering her for years, and finally then she gave that speech about, I already married to a husband in England, and she held up her coronation ring. And then one time she threw a temper tantrum, or she could stage temper tantrums. I think she was always in control, saying, quit bugging me about this. If you don't stop bugging me about this, I'll know you don't care for me and you don't love me. And, they really had a hard time. She always kind of cut them off balance, but she certainly could flatter people very, very much. I mean, one of the courtiers said when she smiles, it is pure sunshine. But then comes a storm, and there's thunder and lightning.
And of course, with her and the situation, she had to be tough. I mean, she had sometimes to like get rid of people who were causing her problems, like Mary Queen of Scots. It was not an easy decision for her.
No. And in fact, she really did not want to, in the sense, for lots of reasons. One, of course, her mother had been executed, and she believed, and many people believed, very unfairly. And so she had all kinds of psychological reasons for withdrawing from that. But also, it sets a terrible example if you can execute an anointed sovereign. And up until that time, that had never happened. That's happened a lot since. You know, all the way up through Louis the 16th and other rulers, Charles the First, but to start this, I mean, then where is this going to end? Because if Mary Queen of Scots, an anointed queen, can be executed, then so can Elizabeth. So she hated to do that for political reasons.
It's a slippery slope.
And also Mary was her cousin. She was the first cousin once removed. And to murder someone in your own family, to execute someone you're quite close blood related to, so it was actually Parliament who came to her and said, "You are putting us in great danger if you don't get rid of this person who wants to assassinate you, and if you want to put us your loyal people in this terrible position where you don't care about your own safety." Then, in fact, you don't love us. And, of course, that was the winning argument because, above all, Elizabeth wanted to be loved by her subjects. And she also could admit the wisdom of this. So she had to kind of grit her teeth and go on and do it. But I think her emotional reaction afterwards was really not fake. I mean, I think it was very hard on her. But being a great politician and statesman, she could do what she had to do when the time came.
And she was very concerned about her country. And England at that time, compared to Spain, was not a rich country.
No. And she had given her subjects peace. And that was the one thing she really played a lot of parts to keep England from having a civil war over religion and all the things that were tearing apart the rest of Europe. And she gave them stability for those 40-odd years that she was queen, and she didn't want to bequeath to them as her parting gift, you know, a nice civil war over the succession. So it was obvious that Mary Queen of Scots' son was really the only candidate who would fulfill what she wanted, which was, one, he had been brought up a Protestant, so he was in the right, you know, camp, because England had to stay Protestant as far as she was concerned. And also he was of the same royal family. I mean, he was by blood. It wasn't like a general taking over. So, but she still didn't really name him, you know, openly.
Well, I know in Parliament someone actually said, you know, you have to name a successor, and she didn't want to do it.
Didn't want to do it, and so you know it became obvious that's who it could be. But she stubbornly, you know, wouldn't do it because. We didn't want to relinquish power because she knew that what happens is when you name your successor and everybody sort of gravitates to that person as the person coming next.
Yeah, like why waste your time with the one who's going? Let's be friendly to the one who's
exactly.
coming.
Exactly. So she said they go to the rising sun rather than the setting one. And she knew that from her own experience when her sister Mary had been queen and she was the heir presumptive. And she just wasn't, even though she was clearly was going, it seemed like at some point she was going to have to appoint one, but she just put it off so long that, in fact, it never really happened. It was just assumed, and I think one of her courtiers claimed that she squeezed his hand when he said, "Shall it be James?" And she squeezed his hand, but you know, that's a he said, she said.
Yeah.
We don't know if that really happened. Because after all, even if there were witnesses there, they wouldn't see the hand being squeezed, or they wouldn't feel it.
Well, you know, she had to just maintain her strength right to the very end, and I think by that point, everyone knew that it was going to be James. There wasn't really any of the ones who had hoped that they would put themselves in a position to knock her out. She had already knocked out. So,
that's true. And the ones that were kind of like in the lineup, they were so far away, genetically, and also they were Spanish or some other where they were not going to be accepted anyway.
So. Oh no, the British wouldn't. The English wouldn't have liked that as happened with in the first place with Henry VIII's first wife. I mean, they never did.
By the way, I wanted to say one thing about the streaming services, and I'm going to get in a plug here just because I enjoyed it. But they made a mini series out of Philippa Gregory's book about Catherine, and it was called The Spanish Princess, and it was on Stars, I think. And anyway, it's about the young Catherine and the young Henry, and I thought it was really good. It was one of those history miniseries that's really fun to watch, and I love the young, handsome, thin Henry, who's usually not portrayed, and I thought the actress playing Catherine was really good.
Yeah, I saw it too, and I thought I agreed, and I did like seeing the young Henry.
Yeah, I really enjoyed it. So they took liberties with history, of course, as they always do. But I found it very engaging, and I'm hoping they do a season two, because of course then you get into the problems of the marriage of Henry and Catherine, and be careful what you wish for. She wanted to be married to Henry. So,
but it is very well done. And, well, of course, Henry actually wasn't, gross and obese and whatever until quite late in his life, because he was energetic and athletic and, so it's not always this image that we have.
I know. And I thought he was a more likely Henry than the Jonathan Rhys Meeres, simply because physically he was more like him. He was tall, and of course the actor had red hair. Whether it's natural or not, I don't know. But Jonathan Rhys Meeres just looked like himself, who wasn't really anything like Henry. He's just because he's short and he had brown hair, and so it was kind of hard to see him as Henry. But this other guy you could really see as Henry.
And he wasn't Charles Laughton.
No, and he wasn't Charles Laughton. Oh, my God.
Oh, gosh. Charles Laughton also played Nero, right? Didn't he?
Did he play Nero? He may have.
I think so.
The Sign of the Cross.
Yes,
the
one of
the cross.
I mean, the people they...
Honestly, maybe that's why I say there's some kind of similarity in the older ones in people's minds.
Yeah, exactly. Yes.
And, of course, Peter Ustinov played Nero,
That's horrific.
In people's minds.
Oh, that's one of the worst. Well, I actually met...
No, we talked about that.
Oh, he was terrible. I didn't like that at all. But I do hope that, your writing is so nuanced, and this book about Elizabeth, as you said, it's about her later years, and it's so fascinating, and you write it so beautifully, and I like how you tell the stories about her, going on a progress and going around the country and meeting, the oldest man in England, things like this. I think all of these little stories, well, certainly in a streaming video, these little stories that you include in the book that aren't major historical moments, they're not the Armada, but I think they make her so interesting and intriguing, and how she goes to a village and finds a golden egg.
Mm-hmm.
I don't know how much of this you just made up yourself, but if you did, it's just brilliant, and I believe it, and I love it.
Well, thank you. Well, yeah, because she had, she did things that weren't all government business, which is, of course, what gets recorded. And the things that she did, these progresses, and some people think it was, partly as a PR tour, because she wanted to meet her subjects in person. And one of her claims to fame, as she said, was, I'm completely English. I'm mere English. My father's English. My mother's English. I'm not any foreign blood. I'm not Spanish. I'm not French. And so she had this bond with the mere English that she went out to be among. And actually, so that was a very strong bond. I think she genuinely felt that for her subjects and had that appeal. Because after her, after that, she was kind of like, that's the last time you had one again, because after that you started getting the ones that had, I guess not James, because he followed her, but then he married a French woman, and so I guess you had one other that was, completely, pure English. And certainly the present royal family was German to begin with, the Hanoverian.
The German and Greek and...
Yeah. So that was a very special time, I think, in English history, that they had a ruler who was completely, English and came from, Anne Boleyn was a commoner. So, and that was, of course, shocking at the time that the king would marry a commoner. But that also gave her that connection with her ordinary people. And I think she really, she was known for going on all these long progresses. And I'm sure that she was the type who would have stopped to see these ordinary people, to see fairs, to meet with people. So apparently that was part of her magic as a ruler.
To connect with the ordinary people and the people that, in fact, she did sacrifice a personal life. Partly, I'm sure, because childbirth, as she knew from her mother and then from, of course, Henry's first wife, Catherine, they lost so many babies and there was so much tragedy and so many women died in childbirth that I can see that it was a good, when you look at it, it was a good decision that I'm the Queen of England. Why am I going to, take this chance?
Yeah.
Although Victoria did it very well. I don't know,
She was like... Yeah, it's interesting. I mean, Parliament was after her to provide an heir, but, as you were saying that, I realized that of Henry's wives, Catherine had a lot of miscarriages. Anne Boleyn had miscarriages. Jane Seymour died after childbirth because of getting infection. And then his last queen, Catherine Parr, she died in childbirth.
Yeah.
So that's a really high tally.
Yeah.
It's not very encouraging statistically wise. And I think Elizabeth was probably smart to just stay out of it and said she liked the courtship, but she didn't really want any of the rest of it.
Yeah, well, have the fun of all the courtship and all the men chasing you and all the men flattering you.
Yeah.
Right until you're 60 years old, they're still flattering her and writing her poetry.
Yeah, with her beautiful cheeks and her supreme beauty.
I love, one of the things I think that makes your book so rich, and the funny thing is I have, as I said, I... Comes sort of now, I don't have enough books to read, Margaret. Margaret, I get 12 books a week, okay? And so I am like always reading when I'm not doing other things, which, nowadays I'm reading so much. I get obsessed with your books, and I'm reading them, and now I'm listening also to them. I love listening to them. The Henry VIII is one of the best Audible books ever. It's just fantastic. And so I'm like, because I now have it in my head, I went back and I reread, because I have all of these books in my library. I have, so I went back and read the Anne Somerset one and the Alison Weir, all of these books, and I'm telling you, none of them compare to your book, and none of them would film so beautifully.
Mm-hmm,
this one, an actress would be, if there's some actress out there who really wants a plum part, this. To take Margaret George's Elizabeth is it's superior. I'm telling you, your Elizabeth is superior to all these other ones.
Well, thank you. I haven't read the other ones, so I tend not to read other people's versions of what I've written, just because if I read it beforehand, I might get influenced. And then afterwards, I kind of feel like that I've known the person, almost like I knew them personally, And so I don't want to read what somebody else has said about them, because, you know, it's like reading something somebody wrote about your best friend, and maybe you feel it would be too, be too invasive or something. So isn't that a funny thing?
It is funny, but, you know, it is having this ability that I have, because I read a lot and I remember, retain a lot. When I read your book, and then I compare, I mean, it is so superior, your grasp of the personality of Elizabeth, I think, is so spot on. Again, these people are somehow they're like, I don't know, they find you in Wisconsin or wherever, and they say, oh, well, you know, we're tired of floating around England. Here we come, and we find Margaret George with her tortoise there, and she's minding her own business. She's just talking to Troilus and just relaxing, and then we jump into her head and take you over.
It's kind of like that, but, you know, that's why I say, when people say, well, who, they suggest things to me, and sometimes they're good ideas, but the people they suggest aren't necessarily going to jump into my head, you know. They kind of have to, I mean, the character has to have its own idea about coming to me. It's more like they come to me than the other way around. So, you know, I could knock on the door forever, say, for, I don't know, Zenobia or Catherine the Great or something like that, and that doesn't mean that they're going to say, oh, fine, you know.
Somehow,
let's have a partnership.
Somehow, I don't know, maybe it's Troilus, maybe it's this love of a tortoise or something.
Yeah.
Somehow these people are coming into your head and take possession, and then you do so beautifully with them. And of course you add depth to it by doing some research and traveling in England
I think one of the key things too that some other authors are denied is the time, because, you know, somebody said about Henry VIII, that book, they said it kind of marinated for ages like a big rich stew with the carrots and the onions and the low oven temperature, and it could just you know, cook away slowly. And I think the emphasis now on time and getting stuff out fast doesn't give people, including me in a way, because my time is short, the opportunity to let the stew marinate and get its flavors out and steep and so on. It's just quick, and I think it shows. I just don't think those kind of things can happen overnight. You've got to allow the time. And, you know, boy, people are really under the gun these days.
Oh, they are. It's way too much, actually. And it's frightening because, you know, as I said, because I get these books really right hot off the press. So a book will come, and then a year later, another book will come, and then a year later. And, I mean, I can feel it, and I can see it in the writing. More and more I can find writers who say, well, I have to have this out. But this is part of the new thing of everybody's supposed to build their own platform and have their own.
Oh, yeah.
You know, and it's very difficult for an author today.
I know, and I feel like especially the people, you know, struggling to come out with some kind of platform. It does kind of remind me of those old things in the Hollywood studios where the studio boss would decide what type you were, and then they would build this whole kind of false image of the person, you know, to sell to the magazines and the fans. And you've got a lot of memoirs of older stars about how they were molded, and I feel like that the authors are being pushed to kind of do that for themselves now. I mean, you don't have a studio head telling you how to do it. You're just told, you know, go get yourself an identity, and it's supposed to be separate from your book.
I know.
They're supposed to want to know all about you as a person, and then they'll buy your books. But the truth is that most of us are just not that interesting. I mean, most of us are sitting in front of a computer writing or reading books, and we can't compete with the characters we're writing about. But we're expected to develop this persona that it's almost like what Elizabeth had to do, you know, with her youthful image and all that. And that's really somehow it got away from the work itself and began to try to develop these personalities. I think it's kind of backward. I don't know if it's working.
No, I think it is backward, and because of that, we're getting a lot of things that aren't quality. And
yeah.
When we're talking about Margaret George, we are talking quality people. Everybody out there, listen to me. If you want really great writing, and I must say the books are you know wonderful, and I'm a book person, but in many ways for some people it is now easier. Audible books are just like, you know, in the old days where a woman would be in the afternoon, she would be sitting there eating chocolates on the
yeah.
divan, and she would have a young girl who would be a reader and read to her. Well, that's what an Audible book is. It's your own personal reader, and you can just pretend that somebody's sitting there reading to you and reading these wonderful books. Can you tell me, in the Audible book, they pronounce, the woman pronounces Devereaux.
I think it's pronounced Devereaux.
It's Devereaux.
The Earl of
yeah.
Devereaux.
Yeah.
Yeah, Devereaux, I think, because it's French.
Yeah, but that's what I thought. I wasn't sure if they did it.
They must have missed. Well, however, though, the reader for that is British.
Yeah, that's what I say. So I thought maybe she does. Maybe that's correct.
Maybe that is correct. I must say I've never met one. there's probably still an Earl of Devereaux Devereux out there. And then there's the opera about him. And of course, that would be in another language anyway. Yeah, you know, maybe the British. So when they were doing the audiobook of Nero, actually, there's so many words in there that not only Latin but Greek, and they wanted to know how to pronounce them. And of course, I didn't know how to pronounce them. I only knew how they were spelled. So actually, I had to ask a classics professor, who is an expert in Greek, to please tell us the pronunciation. And he had to do a voice memos so that he could pronounce these things correctly, and they could be correct on the audio. And we don't think about doing that for an English book, but in fact maybe that would have been a good idea.
Well, I don't know. Either way, Devereaux, Devereux, there are so many wonderful characters in all of your stories, and it's historical, it's brilliant, and I'm running out of time.
Oh.
So Margaret, I have to say goodbye to you, but next time we're going to talk about Mary Queen of Scots.
Okay.
Or as you very appropriately named it, Mary Queen of Scotland and the Isles, which was written in 1992. Oh my
right.
goodness. And that's one of the joys that I have, is to bring books back. You know, mm-hmm. to books that haven't had any publicity for years, you know, that's what I want to do. I don't want these books to be forgotten.
Yeah. Mary got a big sudden boost because of that movie.
Yeah.
It was quite amazing. And once there was a Mary Queen of Scots movie, all of a sudden there was reignited interest in that book and other books on the subject.
Yeah. But again, your version of all of these stories are so, so personal in the fact that these people they're taking over Margaret's mind, everybody.
Yeah.
Just read it and know that Margaret's been possessed. And Margaret, you have a website. It's called margaretgeorge.com. Nothing could be easier. It's a great website. You have pictures there of yourself in England, all about your books. It's a wonderful site. And also we have Troilus. How old is Troilus now?
Oh, we've just celebrated having him 37 years, but he was a grown tortoise when we got him, so we think he's like maybe 65 or 70.
65 or 70. You have to go to Margaret George's website and see it. And Margaret, again, thank you so much, and I'm going to have you back on, and we're going to talk about Mary, okay?
Oh, terrific. Okay, thank you.
Okay. It was a wonderful, wonderful day for me. Bye-bye
thank
now.
Thank you. Bye.
Bye. All right. I just kept talking. I didn't do any commercials. But I do want to say that if you need, and you all need, if you are a writer, you need a lawyer. Believe me, I talk from experience. You need a good lawyer, and you need a lawyer who knows intellectual property, and because it's a very complicated part of the law. And Bill Larson of Larson & Larson is brilliant. He is one of the best in the nation. His company here, although they're located here in St. Petersburg, Florida, Larson & Larson is known nationwide for their absolute super quality work. So if you need to protect your intellectual property, and you have to remember, it's called property because it's valuable. It has a lot of worth. Even if your book's not a bestseller today, you never know when somebody will come along and say, oh, let's make a movie out of that. But if you haven't already protected everything, if you haven't already have everything absolutely perfect, believe me, Hollywood will not take it. Well, they might steal it, but they won't take it and give you money unless you have all the rights and everything recorded and everything in super shape. So contact Bill Larson at Larson & Larson, and he will help you. And he's going to be on the program. Go to my webpage, radio-joyonpaper.com, and you can, there's a form on the front page, and put your question down there. And when Bill comes in, he will answer your question. And I also want to talk about Glenn Erickson. Glenn Erickson supports Joy on Paper. He is an absolutely wonderful, wonderful person. He supports writers all the time. He is writes sci-fi books, and his books are available at Smashwords. And he's working on, I think he's doing some new work, and I'm excited. I'm looking forward to him coming here to talk about his newest books and whatever else he's doing, because he's always so interesting. So that's Glenn Erickson, and that's at Smashwords. And again, well, you know, I just want to thank Margaret George so much. She is absolutely amazing. I had lunch with her one day up in, and it was cold and it was wintertime, but there was Troilus, my goodness, can you imagine, a tortoise 75 years old. And he is absolutely sweet, and it was lots of fun to get to meet him. Anyway, remember what I always tell everyone. One of the joys of life is to see your words on paper, or to hear them in an audible book, or if you're lucky, to hear those magic words, lights, camera, action. And your book might be turned into a major motion picture, a streaming video, or a series on the Hallmark Channel, which is what I am predicting for Carol J. Perry. Carol J. Perry, she was voted, selected number 12 at Barnes & Noble. I mean, this is big. This is big. Carol J. Perry with her lovely, lovely, cozy mystery series, Witch City Mysteries. And she's, oh my goodness, she's on top of some of the biggest names in the world. And it's our very own Carol J. Perry, who was my first guest in the studio just over 4 years ago. And I am so, so proud to know her. And I really think that at some point they're going to pick her up, and we're going to see Carol J. Perry's Witch City Mysteries on television. And that will be really exciting. And anyway, it's a great day today. Wonderful weather here. The sun has come out. And say something nice to somebody today, and I will say something nice to Big Ed in the control room. Thank you, Ed. Okay, he's saluting me. I'm saluting him. I love to be saluted. I wish I had been a general. Thank you.